Henry Ford, the International Jew. Chapter 13, Jewish Plan to Split Society by Ideas. The method by which the protocols work for the breakdown of society should now be fairly evident to readers of these articles. An understanding of the method is necessary if one is to find the meaning of the currents and cross-currents which make so hopeless a hodgepodge of the present times. People who are confused and discouraged by the various voices and discordant theories of today, each seeming to be plausible and promising, may find a clear clue to the value of the voices and the meaning of the theories if they understand that their confusion and discouragement comprise the very objective which is sought. The uncertainty, hesitation, hopelessness, fear, the eagerness with which every promising plan and offered solution is grasped, these are the very reactions which the program outlined in the protocols aims to produce. The condition is proof of the efficacy of the program. It is a method that takes time, and the protocols declare that it has taken time, indeed, centuries. Students of the matter find the identical program of the protocols, announced and operated by the Jewish race, from the first century onward. It has taken 1,900 years to bring Europe to its present degree of subjugation, violent subjugation in some countries, political subjugation in some, economic subjugation in all, but in America the same program, with almost the same degree of success, has required about 50 years. Certain mistaken ideas of liberalism, certain flabby ideas of tolerance, all of them originating at European sources which the protocolists had completely polluted, were transported to America, and here under cover of the blindness and innocence of a false liberalism and tolerance, together with modern appliances for the swift acceleration of opinion, there has been worked a subjugation of our institutions and public thought which is the amazement of European observers. It is a fact that some of the important students of the Jewish question, whom Jewish publicists are pleased to damn with the term anti-Semites, have been awakened to the existence of the question not by what they have observed in Europe, but by what they have seen in the swift and distinct close-up that has been afforded in American affairs. The center of Jewish power, the principal sponsors of the Jewish program, are resident in America, and the leverage which was used at the peace conference to fasten Jewish power more securely upon Europe, was American leverage exercised at the behest of the strong Jewish pressure which was brought from the United States for that purpose. And these activities did not end with the peace conference. The whole method of the protocols may be described in one word: disintegration. The undoing of what has been done, the creation of a long and hopeless interim in which attempts at reconstruction shall be baffled, and the gradual wearing down of public opinion and public confidence, until those who stand outside the created chaos shall insert their strong calm hand to seize control, that is the whole method of procedure. Putting together the estimate of human nature which obtains in these protocols, and their claims to a rather definite though as yet incomplete fulfillment of a world program, these two comprising the themes of the previous two articles, some of the aspects of this propaganda of disintegration have become clear. But not all of them. There are yet other aspects of these methods, which will be dealt with in the present article, and there are yet future reaches of the program which will be considered later. The first point of attack is collective opinion, that body of ideas which through men's agreement with them, holds large groups together in political, racial, religious, or social unity. Sometimes we call them standards, sometimes we call them ideals. Whatever they may be called, they are the invisible bonds of unity, they are the common faith, they are the great overarching reason for group unity and loyalty. The protocols assert that here the first attack has been made. The history of Jewish propaganda in the world shows that also. The first wave of attack is to corrupt collective opinion. Now, to corrupt in the real sense does not mean anything unsavory or unclean. The whole power of every heresy is its attractiveness to the good mind. The whole explanation of the strong hold which untruth has gained upon the world of our day, is that the untruth is reasonable, inspiring and apparently good. It is only after a long discipline in false ideals, which are reasonable, inspiring and good, that the evil fruits appear in acts and conditions which are unreasonable, destructive and wholly evil. If you will trace the idea of liberty as it has appeared in Russian history, from its philosophic beginning, a Jewish beginning, by the way, to its present ending, a Jewish ending also, you will see the process. The protocols claim that the Gentiles are not thinkers, that attractive ideas have been thrown at them so strategically and persistently that the power of thought is almost destroyed out of them. Fortunately, this is a matter on which any Gentile may apply his own test. If he will segregate his ruling ideas, especially those that center around the thought of democracy, he will discover that he is being ruled in his mind by a whole company of ideas into whose authority over him he has not inquired at all. He is ruled by, say so, whose origin he has not traced. And when, pursuing those ideas, he finds that they are not practicable, he is received by the explanation that, we are not yet sufficiently advanced. Yet when he does see men who are sufficiently advanced to put these very ideas into operation, he recoils from what he sees them do, because he knows that advancement such as that is deterioration, a form of disintegration. Yet every one of the ideas were good, reasonable, inspiring, humane, to begin with. And, if this Gentile will observe a little further, he will see that they are the most persistently preached ideas in the world. He will also see who the preachers are. The protocols distinctly declare that it is by means of the set of ideals which cluster around democracy that their first victory over public opinion was obtained. The idea is the weapon. And to be a weapon, it must be an idea at variance with the natural trend of life. It must indeed be a theory opposed to the facts of life. And no theory so opposed can be expected to take root and become the ruling factor, unless it appeals to the mind as reasonable, inspiring and good. The truth frequently seems unreasonable, the truth frequently is depressing, the truth sometimes seems to be evil, but it has this eternal advantage: it is the truth, and what is built thereon neither brings nor yields to confusion. This first step does not give the control of public opinion, but leads up to it. It is worthy of note that it is the sowing of the poison of liberalism, as the protocols name it, which comes first in order in those documents. Then, following upon that, the protocols say, to obtain control over public opinion, it is first necessary to confuse it. Truth is one and cannot be confused, but this false, appealing liberalism which has been sown broadcast, and which is ripening faster under Jewish nurture in America than ever it did in Europe, is easily confused because it is not truth. It is error, and error has a thousand forms. Take a nation, a party, a city, an association in which the poison of liberalism has been sown, and you can split that up into as many factions as there are individuals simply by throwing among them certain modifications of the original idea. This is a piece of strategy well known to the forces that invariably control mass thought. Theodor Herzl, the Arch-Jew, a man whose vision was wider than any statesman's and whose program paralleled the protocols, knew this many years ago when he said that the Zionist, cryptic for Jewish, state would come before the socialist state could come. He knew with what endless divisions the liberalism which he and his predecessors had planted would be shackled and crippled. The process of which all Gentiles have been the victims, but never the Jews, never the Jews, is just this: first, to create an ideal of broad-mindedness. That is the phrase which appears in every Jewish remonstrance against public mention of the Jew and his alleged world program. We thought you were too broad-minded a man to express such thoughts. We thought Mr. So-and-so was too broad-minded a man to suspect the Jews of this. We thought the daily or weekly or monthly such and such a paper was too broad-minded editorially to consider such material. It is a sort of keyword, indicative of the state of mind in which it is desired that the Gentiles be kept. It is a state of flabby tolerance. A state of mind which mouths meaningless phrases about liberty, phrases which act as an opiate on the mind and conscience and which allow all sorts of things to be done under cover. The phrase, the slogan, is a very dependable Jewish weapon, In all times people have accepted words for acts. Protocol 5. The reality behind the phrase the protocols frankly admit to be non-existent. Nothing has served to create broad-mindedness, a state of mind whose breadth indicates its lack of depth, so much as the ideas of liberalism which the Jews are constantly teaching to Gentiles and on which they never themselves act. We need a new sort of allegiance to the reality of life, to the facts as they are, which will enable us to stand up under all cajoling to broad-mindedness, and assert a new intolerance of everything but truth. The terms narrow and broad as they are used today represent lies. The liberal man ought to believe more, he ought to be deep and wide in his beliefs in order to merit that name, but as a usual thing he believes nothing. He is not liberal at all. When you seek belief, belief with the foundation, belief with vitality, you must seek it among men who are sneered at, under this false Jewish propagated notion of liberality, as narrow men. Jewish propaganda, in common with the protocols, is against men who have dug down to the rock. They want broad-minded men, who can easily be shifted about the surface and thus serve the invisible scheme in any manner desired. This type of men, on their part, never imagine but that their broad-mindedness is a mark of their superiority and independence. Now, see what follows. Men are born believers. For a time they may believe in broad-mindedness, and under the terrific pressure that has been set up in its favor they will openly espouse it. But it is too shallow to satisfy any growing routes of life. They must believe, deeply, something. For proof of this, notice the undeniable strength of the negative beliefs which are held by men who fancy that they believe nothing. Therefore, some who are highly endowed with independence of spirit, root down into those prohibited matters which at some point touch Jewish concerns, these are the narrow men. But others find it more convenient to cultivate those departments which promise a highway whereon there shall be no clashes of vital opinion, no chance of the charge of intolerance. In short, they transfer all their contemplative powers to the active life, even as it is written in the protocols to divert Gentile thought and observation, interest must be deflected to industry and commerce. It is amazing to look around and see the number of men who have been actually browbeaten into committing their whole lives to these secondary or even tertiary things, while they look with great timidity and aversion at the vital things which really rule the world and upon the issue of which the world really depends. But it is just this deflection to the materialistic base that offers the protocolists, and similarly Jewish propagandists, their best hold. Broad-mindedness today consists in leaving vital matters severely alone. It descends quickly to material-mindedness. Within this lower sphere all the discord which distresses the world today is to be found. First, there is the ruin of the upper circles of industry and commerce. To make it possible for liberty definitely to disintegrate and ruin Gentile society, industry must be placed on a speculative basis. No one needs to be told what this means. It means, as everything about us shouts, the prostitution of service to profits and the eventual disappearance of the profits. It means that the high art of management degenerates into exploitation. It means reckless confusion among the managers and dangerous unrest among the workmen. But it means something worse. It means the splitting up of Gentile society. Not a division between capital and labor, but the division between the Gentiles at both ends of the working scheme. Gentile managers and manufacturers are not the capitalists of the United States. Most of them have to go to the capitalists for the funds with which they work. And the capitalists are Jewish, international Jews. But with Jewish capital at one end of the Gentile working scheme putting the screws on the manufacturers, and with Jewish agitators and disruptionists and subversives at the other end of the Gentile working scheme putting the screws on the workmen, we have a condition at which the world managers of the protocol program must be immensely satisfied. We might fear the combined strength of the Gentiles of vision with the blind strength of the masses, but we have taken all measures against such a possible contingency by raising a wall of mutual antagonism between these two forces. Thus, the blind force of the masses remains our support. We, and we alone, shall serve as their leaders. Naturally, we will direct their energy to achieve our end. Protocol 9. This indication that they are highly satisfied is that they are not only not doing anything to relieve the situation, but are apparently willing to have it made worse, and if it be at all possible for them to do so, they would like to see this coming winter, and the privations which are scheduled for it, unless Gentile flabbiness before the Jewish power, high and low, receives a new backbone, bring the United States to the verge of, if not across the very line of Bolshevism. They know the whole method of artificial scarcity and high prices. It was practiced in the French Revolution and in Russia. All the signs of it are in this country too. Industrial problems for their mental food and light amusement for their leisure hours, these are the protocol's method with regard to the Gentile mind, and under cover of these the work is to be done, the work which is best expressed by the motto, divide and rule. Read this. To divert over restless people from discussing political questions, we shall now bring forward new problems apparently connected with them, problems of industry. Protocol 13. Has not everyone been struck by the divorcement which exists in this country between the mass thought which is almost exclusively devoted to industrial questions, and the party thought which is endeavoring to keep the field of pure politics? And is it not a fact that our friends, the Jews, are strongly entrenched in both fields, in politics to keep it reactionary, and in industrial circles to keep it radical, and so widen the split? And what is this split but a split of the Gentiles? For society is Gentile, and the disruptive influences are Jewish. Read this. We have included in the Constitution rights for the people that are factitious and not actual rights. All those so-called rights of the people can only exist in the abstract and can never be realized in practice. The proletarian gains no more from the Constitution than the miserable crumbs thrown from our table in return for his votes to elect our agents and pass our measures. Republican rights are a bitter irony to the poor man, for the pressure of daily labor prevents him from using them, and at the same time, deprives him of the guarantee of a permanent and certain livelihood by making him dependent upon strikes, organized either by his employers or his comrades. Protocol 3. This remark about strikes is not at all puzzling to anyone who has studied the different types of strikes in this country. The number fomented from above the working class is astoundingly large. Read this also. We will force up wages, which, however, will be of no benefit to the workers, for we will at the same time cause a rise in the prices of necessities, pretending that this is due to the decline of agriculture and of cattle raising. We will also artfully and deeply undermine the sources of production by instilling in the workmen ideas of anarchy. Protocol 6. And this. We will represent ourselves as the saviors of the working class who have come to liberate them from this oppression by suggesting that they join our army of socialists, anarchists, communists, to whom we always extend our help under the guise of the fraternal principles of universal human solidarity. Protocol 3. Broad-mindedness, again. In this connection it is always well to remember the words of Sir Eustace Percy, heretofore quoted, words which are sponsored by Jews themselves, not because the Jew cares for the positive side of radical philosophy, not because he desires to be a partaker in Gentile nationalism or Gentile democracy, but because no existing Gentile system of government is ever anything but distasteful to him. Or, as the author of The Conquering Jew says, he is democratic in his sentiments, but not in his nature. When he proclaims the common brotherhood of man, he is asking that the social gate now closed against him in so many quarters shall be opened to him, not because he wants equality, but because he desires to be master in the social world, as he is showing himself in so many other spheres. Many an honorable Jew will, I doubt not, dispute the accuracy of this distinction, but if he does it will be because he has lived so long in the atmosphere of the West that he is unconscious of what is bred in the bone of his Eastern race. It is not difficult, therefore, to see the genealogy of the Jewish ideas of liberalism from their origin to their latest effects upon Gentile life. The confusion aimed for is here. There is not a reader of these lines who has not felt in his own life the burden of it. Bewilderment characterizes the whole mental climate of the people today. They do not know what to believe. First one set of facts is given to them, then another. First one explanation of conditions is given to them, and then another. The fact shortage is acute. There is a whole market full of explanations that explain nothing, but only deepen the confusion. The government itself seems to be hampered, and whenever it starts on a line of investigation finds itself mysteriously tangled up so that procedure is difficult. This governmental aspect is also set forth in the protocols. Add to this the onslaught on the human tendency toward religion, which is usually the last barrier to fall before violence and robbery unashamed stalk forth. In order to bring the condition about at which this world program aims, the fourth protocol says, it is for this reason that we must undermine faith, eradicate from the minds of the Gentiles the very principles of God and soul, and replace these conceptions by mathematical calculations and material desires. When we deprived the masses of their belief in God, ruling authority was thrown into the gutter, where it became public property, and we seized it. Protocol 5. We have taken good care long ago to discredit the Gentile clergy. Protocol 17. When we become rulers, we shall regard as undesirable the existence of any religion except our own, proclaiming one God with whom our fate is tied as the chosen people, and by whom our fate has been made one with the fate of the world. For this reason we must destroy all other religions. If thereby should emerge contemporary atheists, then, as a transition step, this will not interfere with our aims. Protocol 14. This will probably offer matter for reflection by the broad-minded. It is curious to note how this religious program has worked out in Russia, where Trotsky, as loudly heralded in the American Jewish press, is said to have no religion, and where Jewish commissars tell dying Russians who ask for priests, "We have abolished the Almighty." Miss Catherine Dokukif is reported, under a Philadelphia date, to have told the Near East Relief that Russian Christian churches have been subjected to the vilest indignities by the Bolsheviki, details of which she gives, but the synagogues remain untouched, meeting with no damage. All these lines of attack, whose object is the destruction of the natural rallying points of Gentile thought, and the substitution of other rallying points of an unwholesome and destructive nature, are assisted, as we saw in the last article, by the propaganda for luxury. Luxury is recognizedly one of the most enervating influences. Its course runs from ease, through softness, to flabbiness, to degeneracy, mental, physical, and moral. Its beginnings are attractive, its end is lasciviousness in some form, testifying to the complete breakdown of all the strong fiber of the life. It may make a theme for a more complete study someday, this lure to lasciviousness through luxury, and the identity of the forces that set the lure. But now, to conclude this general view of the method, rather this part of the method, the confusion itself, which all these influences converge to produce, is expected to produce another more deeply helpless state. And that state is exhaustion. It needs no imagination to see what this means. Exhaustion is today one of the conditions that menace the people. The recent political conventions and their effect upon the public fully illustrate it. Nobody seemed to care. Parties might make their declarations and candidates their promises, nobody cared. The war and its strain began the exhaustion, the peace and its confusion have about completed it. The people believe little and expect less. Confidence is gone. Initiative is nearly gone. The failure of movements falsely heralded as people's movements has gone far to make the people think that no people's movement is possible. So say the protocols. To wear everyone out by dissensions, animosities, feuds, famine, inoculation of diseases, want, until the Gentiles see no other way of escape except an appeal to our money and power. Protocol 10. We will so wear out and exhaust the Gentiles by all this that they will be compelled to offer us an international authority, which by its position will enable us to absorb without disturbance all the governmental forces of the world and thus form a super-government. We must so direct the education of Gentile society that its hands will drop in the weakness of discouragement in the face of any undertaking where initiative is needed. Protocol 5. The Jews have never been worn out or exhausted. They have never been nonplussed. This is the true psychic characteristic of those who have a clue to the maze. It is the unknown that exhausts the mind, the constant wandering around among tendencies and influences whose source is not known and whose purpose is not understood. Walking in the dark is wearing work. The Gentiles have been doing it for centuries. The others, having a pretty accurate idea what it was all about, have not succumbed. Even persecution is endurable if it is understandable, and the Jews of the world have always known just where it fitted in the scheme of things. Gentiles have suffered from Jewish persecutions than have the Jews, for after the persecutions were over, the Gentile was as much in the dark as ever, whereas Judaism simply took up again its century-long march toward a goal in which it implicitly believes, and which, some say who have deep knowledge of Jewish roots in the world and who too may be touched with exhaustion, they will achieve. However this may be, the revolution which would be necessary to unfasten the international Jewish system from its grip on the world, would probably have to be just as radical as any attempts the Jews have made to attain that grip. There are those who express serious doubts that the Gentiles are competent to do it at all. Maybe not. Let them at least know who their conquerors are. The Dearborn Independent, issue of 14th of August 1920.